Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for a Monday, January 4th, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. Top campaign surrogates in Georgia before Tuesday's U.S. Senate runoff elections to determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. The surrogates including President Donald Trump, Vice President Mike Pence, and President-elect Joe Biden. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris was there on Sunday. Latest polls showing both races are super close. Fallout from the phone call with President Trump's asking Georgia's Secretary of State to find more than 11,000 more votes to reverse Biden's victory in the presidential election. We'll talk with the Washington Post reporter who broke the story. Washington, D.C. activating 340 National Guard troops ahead of Congress's counting the electoral votes in the presidential race on Wednesday, preparing for potentially violent protests. And the U.S. House begins work in the 117th Congress today, debating procedural rules changes written by the majority Democrats and vigorously opposed by the minority Republicans, who say their rights are being taken away. We'll get the latest from a reporter, the newspaper Roll Call. Newsweek reports the final polls conducted in the Georgia Senate runoff races between Republicans David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler versus Democrats John Ossoff and Raphael Warnock, respectively, show each contest in a dead heat one day before the election. Perdue and Ossoff have 50% each. Warnock holds a 50 to 49% edge over Loeffler, well within the margin of error. And Newsweek goes on that the latest PollSmart MR online poll aggregate conducted by Targaz Market Research shows fewer than 1% of likely Election Day voters are still undecided in who they're going to vote for Tuesday. President-elect Joe Biden went to Atlanta to campaign for the Democratic candidates.
By electing John and the Reverend, you can make an immediate difference in your own lives, the lives of the people all across this country, because their election will put an end to the block in Washington, that $2,000 stimulus check, that money that will go out the door immediately, tell people who are in real trouble. Think about what it will mean to your lives. Putting food on the table, paying rent, paying your mortgage, paying down the credit card, paying the phone bill, the gas bill, the electric bill. Just look around. Millions of people in this country out of work through no fault of their own. No fault of their own. They're struggling. Many are fearful, and many have given up hope. Look at the lines at food banks. Hours and hours and hours. This is the United States of America, for God's sake. And their food lines, like we've not seen since the Depression. And they're getting longer. Families, children, people have worked their whole lives and never asked for a thing except a fighting chance. Now they're lining up for food in America. And the debate over $2,000 isn't some abstract debate in Washington. It's about real lives, your lives, the lives of good, hardworking Americans. And if you're like millions of Americans all across this country, you need the money, you need the help, and you need it now. Look, Georgia, there's no one in America with more power to make that happen than you, the citizens of Atlanta, the citizens of Georgia. And that's not an exaggeration. That is a literal, that's literally true. If you send John and the Reverend to Washington, those $2,000 checks will go out the door, restoring hope and decency and honor for so many people who are struggling right now. And if you send Senators Perdue and Loeffler back to Washington, those checks will never get there. It's just that simple. The power is literally in your hands. By electing John and the Reverend, you can break the gridlock that has gripped Washington and this nation. With their votes in the Senate, we'll be able to make the progress we need to make on jobs, on health care, on justice, on the environment, on so many important things. By electing John and the Reverend, you'll be voting to get the states the resources they need to get the vaccines distributed. It's a shame what's happening now. It's a literal shame. I've said it before. Getting America vaccinated will be one of the most difficult operational challenges this nation has ever faced. But we've known it for the last months. This administration has gotten off to a god-awful start. The president spends more time whining and complaining than doing something about the problem. I don't know why he still wants the job. He doesn't want to do the work.
President-elect Joe Biden in Atlanta. If either of the incumbent Republican senators from Georgia hold their seats in tomorrow's election, then Republicans will maintain the majority in the Senate in the new Congress. If the Democratic challengers both win, that would mean a 50-50 party split in the U.S. Senate, allowing Vice President-elect Kamala Harris, when she's sworn in, to cast the tie-breaking vote and give Democrats majority control. Vice President Mike Pence campaigning today for the Republicans in Milner, Georgia.
If you haven't already cast your vote, remember, if you're heading out tomorrow, friends, don't let friends vote alone. Bring a family member, bring a neighbor, and vote to send David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler back to Washington, D.C. You know, I know we all got our doubts about the last election. And I want to assure you, I share the concerns of millions of Americans about voting irregularities. And I promise you, come this Wednesday, we'll have our day in Congress. We'll hear the objections. We'll hear the evidence. But tomorrow is Georgia's day. So for our faith, for our freedom, we need you to vote, Georgia, vote to send David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler back to the United States Senate. You know, I actually hear some people saying, just don't vote. But men and women of Georgia, if you don't vote, they win. If you don't vote, there could be nothing stopping Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi from cutting our military, raising taxes, and passing the agenda of the radical left. So for all we've done, for all we have yet to do, for our president, for our faith, for our freedoms, for Georgia and America, cast another vote for all that President Trump has accomplished. Cast a vote to send David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler back to the United States Senate. We've got to have Georgia hold the line. Will you do it? I believe you will. I believe you will because I have faith. It's like all of you. I have faith in the people of this state. The people of this state represent all that's great about this country. But family and faith and freedom. And I just know that you're going to get out. You're going to cast that vote. You're going to talk to your neighbors and friends in every hour that remains between now and when the polls close tomorrow. And tell them what's at stake in this election. The eyes of America are on Georgia. And people who share our values and our ideals across this country, we're looking to you. We're looking to you, Georgia. We're looking to you to hold the line, and I believe with all my heart that you will. And lastly, I have that other kind of faith, too. The challenging times in which we live, I believe more than ever that we stand in the need of prayer.
Vice President Mike Pence in Milner, Georgia. CNN reporting that the Georgia Secretary of State's office said that as of Monday morning, a record 3 million votes have been cast already, early votes, in the Senate runoff elections in Georgia. About 2 million of those in person early and a million or so by mail-in ballot. By comparison, just over 5 million total votes were cast in Georgia in the November elections, both early and same day. On Tuesday, Election Day, C-SPAN will be simulcasting WSB-TV in Atlanta for election night coverage starting at 8 p.m. Eastern, C-SPAN Radio, and here on C-SPAN Television. Listen anywhere on the free C-SPAN Radio app. President Donald Trump criticizing Republican Senator Tom Cotton today after the senator said he would not join an effort to object to certifying the presidential votes in Georgia and other swing states during Wednesday's Electoral College vote counting in a joint session of Congress, a count that will lock in President-elect Joe Biden's victory. President Trump tweeting, "Republicans have pluses and minuses, but one thing is sure, they never forget." President Trump held that phone call with Georgia election officials on Saturday, trying to get them to overturn Joe Biden's victory there. Audio released on Sunday. Here's a few minutes of the call that ran about an hour.
They should share it because you want to get to an honest election. I won this election by hundreds of thousands of votes. There's no way I lost Georgia. There's no way. We won by hundreds of thousands of votes. I'm just going by small numbers. When you add them up, they're many times the 11,000. But I won that state by hundreds of thousands of votes. Now, do you think it's possible that they shredded ballots in Fulton County? Because that's what the rumor is. And also that Dominion took out machines. That Dominion is really moving fast to get rid of their machinery. Do you know anything about that? Because that's illegal.
This is Ryan Germany. No, Dominion is not. Moved any machinery out of Fulton County. We're having
have they moved the inner parts of the machines and replaced them with other parts?
No.
You sure, Ryan?
I'm sure. I'm sure, Mr. President.
And what about the ballots? The shredding of the ballots. Have they been shredding ballots?
No. The only investigation that we have into that, they have not been shredding any ballots. There was an issue in Cobb County where they were doing normal, office shredding, getting rid of old stuff. And we investigated that. But this is stuff from, past elections.
No, I don't know.
It doesn't
pass the smell test, though, because we hear they're shredding thousands and thousands of ballots. And now what they're saying, we're just cleaning up the office. I don't think that plays.
Mr. President, the problem you have with social media, people can say anything.
No, this isn't social media. This is Trump media. It's not social media. It's really not. It's not social media. I don't care about social media. I couldn't care less. Social media is big tech. Big tech is on your side. I don't even know why you have a side, because you should want to have an accurate election. And you're a Republican.
We believe that we do have an accurate election.
No, you don't have, not even close. You're off by hundreds of thousands of votes, and just on the small numbers, you're off on these numbers.
President Donald Trump with Georgia's Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and Ryan Germany, an attorney in Raffensperger's office. That phone call from Saturday, the audio released Sunday. Reaction from Republican lawmakers to this has been mixed. Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Illinois tells The Hill newspaper, "It was bizarre. It was obviously way over the top. You look at that and you see a president repeating stuff you read on Twitter that's been debunked." But Senator David Perdue of Georgia says President Trump has just been consistent in his allegations of fraud, which should be investigated.
To have a statewide elected official, regardless of party, tape without disclosing a conversation, private conversation with the President of the United States, and then leaking it to the press, is disgusting. But I didn't hear anything in that tape that the President hasn't already said for weeks now since the November election, calling for some sort of investigation, some sort of resolution to the improprieties and the irregularities that we now see happened in November here in Georgia.
Perhaps then you're not seeing what Jonathan Turley saw when he said it was absolutely breathtaking to hear the president use the words, "I just want to find the 11,780 votes." He's a constitutional law professor. Ari Fleischer said pretty much everything the president said on that call was wrong. Used to be the press secretary for George Bush. Adam Kinzinger, a Republican, called what the president did there on pressuring the Secretary of State absolutely appalling. So, sir, you've reacted to the leaking of that call and the actual taping of it. Got it. But what about the contents of that call?
Well, however he said it, Sandra, what he's saying, a lot of people in Georgia, and 75 million Americans, I think, align with him right now, that something untoward happened here in Georgia, and we have not gotten to the bottom of it. Right away, I asked the Secretary of State for some things that didn't happen. We called for his resignation. We asked for a special session of the General Assembly to investigate. That didn't happen, so we went to court. They told us it was a legislative issue, and so we have pulled out all the stops to try to fight with the president to get the right accounting. Look, I missed this runoff by just a few thousand votes myself. We beat our opponent by 2%. In every other state but one, we would already be reelected. We know the probability of the low number of absentee ballots that were rejected is 1 in 10,000. That's the probability that you would have numbers like we had in Georgia in November. So until somebody looks at that, I've been calling for weeks to object to the electors, because in the state of Georgia, I don't believe that we should have certified this election yet.
Senator David Perdue on Fox News with Sandra Smith Monday morning. Georgia's voting system implementation manager Gabriel Sterling held a news conference in Atlanta Monday afternoon, and he said that he was frustrated when he heard the audio of that phone call with President Trump, and saying that the president again was lobbying unfounded accusations.
So then we see also, while the monitors and the press are still in the room, they bring out the carriers, which are normal absentee ballot carriers. And I will admit, when I listened to the audio of the phone call and the president brought that up again and I heard it on a radio ad again today, I wanted to scream. I did scream at the computer, and I screamed in my car at the radio talking about this, because this has been thoroughly debunked. They bring out the normal absentee ballot carriers. There are monitors in the room. There is press in the room. They take the ballots that have been opened, put them in carrier trays, and put them in there, and then put them in the boxes, put the lid on because the lid matches the box, and then you see, at one point during the video, a woman crawling on the floor, putting the numbered seals on them so they can keep the chain of custody. Approximately 10:25, 10:30, the secretary in our office receives word that Fulton County is shutting down for the night at State Farm Arena. So, as some of y'all who were there on election night recall, the secretary got a little irritated with this and made his feelings quite known. He says, some of us will be working through the night. We're glad to see that Fulton County sees the need to just go ahead and knock off for the evening. So Chris Harvey, our elections director, then calls Rick Barron, the elections director of Fulton County, who was at the other location, which was their English Street warehouse, because he was doing election day activities. Chris calls Rick. Rick says, we're not shutting down. Well, Chris says, it looks like you are. So then you can go back to the videotape and see Ralph Jones take a phone call of approximately almost 11 o'clock. And you can see his shoulders kind of shrug. He takes the phone call. He's being told at that point by his boss, Rick Barron, you need to stay and continue to scan. So he hangs up the phone. He goes over to some boxes, puts some more seals on them, because obviously, if you watch the videotape, many of the people that are there have been there since 7 in the morning. It's already 11 o'clock at night. They were all under the impression they were going to get to go home. So you see him spend about 30 seconds going, heck, what am I going to say to these people? So then he walks back over to the corner of a desk and says, I got the word, we got to keep on scanning. So they go back to the boxes that you see them put under the table at the approximately 10 o'clock hour. There is videotape of this. And this is what's really frustrating. The president's legal team had the entire tape. They watched the entire tape and then, and from our point of view, intentionally misled the state Senate, voters, and the people of the United States about this. It was intentional, it was obvious, and anybody watching this knows that. Anyone watching it knows that.
Gabriel Sterling, Georgia's voting system implementation manager, at a news conference today in Atlanta, referring to President Donald Trump on the phone call with the Georgia Secretary of State, the audio released yesterday, and the president saying about that videotape of the facility, State Farm Arena, Fulton County, Georgia, the president saying there were thousands and thousands of ballots in a box that were not an official or sealed box. Gabriel Sterling also asked his general impressions of the president's phone call.
Yes. As some have said, do you believe that what happened in that phone call was an attack on democracy?
I'll leave other people to make the decision on that. I personally found it to be something that was not normal, out of place, and nobody I know who would be president would do something like that to a Secretary of State.
Joining us now with more is Amy Gardner, the Washington Post national political reporter who broke this story over the weekend. Thanks for being with us. So it's been described as an extraordinary call. When you first heard it, and you were one of the first, what struck you?
I was expecting to hear, cajoling, and I knew that President Trump had not given up, wasn't really able or willing to accept his defeat. And, you know, we'd been reading about these conversations he was having with aides. For weeks, he's been calling into other states where he's contesting the result. And so on one level, I wasn't surprised that he's still doing it. On another level, hearing him talk that way for over an hour on this call was quite remarkable and stunning to me even. And I'm in this, you know, it's my job. It's been my beat to cover the contested election these last few weeks. So, and I think the reason it was stunning is that hearing him in this truly desperate and emotional way beg a state election official to flip the result of this, you know, the certified legal result of an election, and careen from insulting him, flattering him, attacking him, begging with him, pleading, cajoling. It was so sort of meandering and at times a little bit incoherent, because some of the theories that he was putting forth alleging fraud were thoroughly, thoroughly false and have been debunked. And so that was stunning to hear a sitting president of the United States look so desperate. And I'm not sure that there are other instances of that in history. My history is not as sharp as it should be on this, of such a moment in public, such a moment of desperation.
You write that even after this hour, and he tried every tactic, he said that he recognized he was failing. He wasn't getting anywhere. And he says, I know this phone call is going nowhere. And yet today, yeah, he is again tweeting about the certification of fraudulent presidential numbers. So where is he on this?
The way that some of his aides and people close to him have described it in interviews, you know, and confidential, you know, background conversations over the last couple of days, is like a child who cannot let go. And it's not necessarily rational. It's just an inability or unwillingness to give up, to let go of this thing that he can't have. You know, I think that's a big part of it. I think another part of it is that so far, I'm not aware of him continuing to make calls into some of those other states that he had originally been contesting. So far, I'm only aware of this happening in Georgia. And I'm starting to think, and I'm hearing from sources in Georgia, the same theory, that he has a peculiar obsession with Georgia. He's really angry with Brian Kemp, the governor, whom he endorsed in 2018 and believes is responsible for his victory, and feels as though Kemp betrayed him by not espousing and repeating the allegations of fraud, by certifying the election results, by signing the certification. And so he's incredibly angry at him. He also disdains Stacey Abrams, the Democrat whom Kemp narrowly beat in 2018, and talks about her on the call and mentioned her in his last trip to Georgia when he had that rally in Valdosta. And I guarantee he'll mention her tonight in Dalton. And I think that there's just something about losing Georgia when these two senators didn't outright lose, at least not yet, that really hurts his ego. He's been really clear that he doesn't like to lose, that he finds it very, very difficult to lose. And I think all of that has made Georgia his obsession. I've even spoken to Republicans in Georgia who think he doesn't care if Loeffler and Perdue win or lose. And there's even advantage to him personally if they lose, because it salves his ego that another Republican or two also lost in Georgia so that he's not the only one. And secondly, it allows him to continue propagating these false theories about fraud. If they win, the fraud argument kind of disappears in Georgia, right? And so I think Georgia is a particular, peculiar place of grievance for Trump for all of those reasons. Not just grievance, but also opportunity, right?
We're talking with Amy Gardner, Washington Post reporter. Reaction from the Democrats. There have been calls for more investigations of what the president said, maybe even another impeachment. And on the Republican side, it's been split. Some condemning it, some supporting the president.
Right. I mean, I think it's worth noting that since the call was published, since we published the call yesterday, there have been a small number of Republicans who have been loyal to Trump thus far, who have said that they didn't like what was on the call. Liz Cheney, the member of the Republican House leadership, said that she found the call deeply troubling, and she urged all Americans to listen to the entire hour. Last night, Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas put a statement out saying that he was not going to vote to challenge the Electoral College result on Wednesday when the joint session convenes. And it seems pretty clear that that the call might have influenced him. His statement came out after the call came out. And one wonders if those group of, I forget, is it 11 or 12 senators who are saying that they are going to challenge the result, one wonders if any of them feel exposed and wishing that they hadn't joined on to that gambit after they heard the call. Because the call makes it sound like Trump wants Raffensperger to illegally flip the election, to steal the election for Trump. I mean, that's the way a lot of folks are interpreting that call. And I think that was a bridge too far for some people.
Amy Gardner, Washington Post national political reporter. Read her work at WashingtonPost.com and follow her on Twitter at Amy E. Gardner. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is Washington Today. More in a minute. Welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. President Donald Trump awarding the Presidential Medal of Freedom to Republican Congressman Devin Nunes for Nunes's, quote, courageous actions helping thwart a plot to take down a sitting U.S. president. A reference to the investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 U.S. election and possible Trump campaign connections, something the president calls the Russia hoax. The Presidential Medal of Freedom is the highest civilian award in the nation. And the president also reportedly will be giving it to another Republican congressman, Jim Jordan. And Iran began enriching uranium today to levels unseen since its 2015 nuclear deal with world powers that the U.S. has pulled out of. Iran also seizing a South Korean-flagged tanker near the crucial Strait of Hormuz. U.S. House of Representatives beginning the first legislative day of the 117th Congress today by debating and voting on a package of changes to the House rules. Democrat James McGovern, Rules Committee Chair, presenting the resolution on the House floor.
Madam Speaker, as we stand here in the opening days of this Congress, I am proud that the reforms before us represent a collaborative process that began many months ago. We asked members on both sides of the aisle for ideas. We listened to our many caucuses and coalitions. We spent hours in the Rules Committee listening to input during our Member Day hearing. And we spoke with the outside groups that study these issues. Weeks and weeks of thoughtful discussion got us to this point. That process made the final product an even stronger one. Not for one party or the other, but for this institution and for all those Americans counting on us to represent them. Not the special interests or the moneyed interests, but our workers and those struggling to get ahead. This is a rules package that encourages us to tackle the most pressing issues facing our nation today, like climate change through the continued work of the Select Committee on the Climate Crisis. And I want to thank Chairwoman Castor for her leadership, along with Chairman Pallone and Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez, who have encouraged us to think big when confronting the threat of climate change. And we are confronting the pandemic without any waste or fraud. That's through the ongoing work of the Select Committee on the Coronavirus Crisis under the stewardship of Chairman Clyburn. It makes reforms to our budget rules so that we can deal with these dual challenges through an all-hands-on-deck approach while maintaining fiscal responsibility. And I want to recognize the many members, especially the Blue Dogs, the Progressives, and the New Democrats, who work together to make this compromise happen. We are also focusing on those who have traditionally been left behind through the creation of a new Select Committee on Economic Disparity and Fairness and Growth, And I want to thank Speaker Pelosi for her commitment to making sure our policies lift up every single American.
Democratic Congressman James McGovern, the Rules Committee chairman. The ranking Republican on the committee is Tom Cole. He opposed the rules changes on the House floor, particularly a change to the minority's ability to amend legislation.
We're here today, Madam Speaker, to address the majority's proposed changes in the rules of the House of Representatives for the 117th Congress. These changes are some of the harshest and most cynical that I've experienced during my time in Congress. Democratic leadership is supporting minority rights and paving the way for the and suppressing, excuse me, minority rights and paving the way for the Green New Deal by intentionally removing budgetary checks that have been in place for over a decade. The most egregious of these changes is the complete gutting of the motion to recommit. The motion to recommit, or the MTR, is the minority's right to propose a final amendment before moving passage. This is a right that has been guaranteed to the minority for well over a century. With today's changes, the majority seeking to silence views they are afraid of, with no regard for this institution or the American people's trust in our constitutional responsibility to govern and govern well. They are taking away the ability to debate a motion to recommit and the ability to offer a motion to recommit with instructions. This completely guts the minority's ability to offer a last amendment on the floor prior to passage of legislation. I would remind my colleagues that during the many years Republicans were in the majority, we never even thought to deny the minority this motion. And the only reason Democrats are doing so today is out of embarrassment. They're embarrassed that the Republicans were able to pass 8 motions to recommit in the 116th Congress. But rather than acknowledging that Republicans sometimes have good policy ideas that should be incorporated into legislation, the majority is instead seeking to completely cut off this key right. And that, Madam Speaker, is simply reprehensible.
Republican Congressman Tom Cole, ranking member on the Rules Committee on the House floor. And joining us now with more on this House rules package for the 117th Congress is Lindsay McPherson, senior House reporter with Roll Call. Thank you for being with us. A lot of focus on this change to the motion to recommit.
So the motion to recommit is one of the few votes that the minority party in the House controls. On most major bills that go to the House floor, the ones that are brought under a rule, there is a motion to recommit given to the minority in which they can offer what has turned into recent years as last-minute amendments to the bill, but it had started as more of kind of a procedural vote, and it's taken various forms over the years. Different parties have treated it differently. There were years ago, it used to be a motion to kind of effectively kill the bill by voting to send it back to committee. Republicans in recent years have actually offered substantive amendments to change the text of the bill on the floor. And in this past Congress, at least 8 different times, enough Democrats voted with Republicans to actually make those substantive amendments to the bill, to the frustration of party leaders who wanted their party to treat this as a procedural vote. And so what they decided to do is to basically change the motion so that you can't make any last-minute changes on the floor and that you can only send the bill back to committee, and that basically turns it back into what they think it was intended to be, which is a procedural vote.
The minority leader, Kevin McCarthy, called this change a nuclear option. What do you make of that kind of language?
I mean, it is certainly a big change. And particularly from the Republican perspective, it's not fair to them, you know, for the Democrats to just be getting rid of it because they have not been able to control their members voting with Republicans on to adopt some of these motions to recommit. Their point is, you know, if you guys view it as a procedural motion, then you shouldn't need to change the rules, that you should be able to convince your party to vote against it because you're saying it's procedural. It's not, you know, meant to be anything but. And that's kind of the problem that happened is, you know, Democrats until last Congress had been in the minority for years. So they had a bunch of new members come in last Congress, and they honestly just didn't take time to explain to the caucus what the motion recommit is, how it works, how party leaders view it, how Republicans treated it in the past Congress. Because Republicans, when the 8 years they were in the majority, uniformly voted against Democrats' motions to recommit. So they never had the same issue. So I think the Republicans certainly have a point. This is a big change, and it certainly will limit their ability to change legislation on the floor. But what they're offering most of the time is, you know, kind of more of a political vote. We're trying to catch you in voting on controversial language on immigration and other matters. Occasionally they do offer amendments that are broadly supported and have made substantive changes.
What other changes are in this House rules package offered by the Democrats?
So one of the big ones that's a big deal on the Democratic side is there are two effective exemptions to the PAYGO rule, that's pay-as-you-go, which is a longstanding provision in the House rules that says if you're going to pass legislation that costs money, it needs to be offset. This rule has been routinely waived to allow the House to pass legislation without fully offsetting it. But fiscal conservatives on the Republican side, as well as some fiscally conservative Democrats, have, you know, been big champions of PAYGO. But in recent years, progressive Democrats have argued that that has hampered their ability to push their priorities on costly things like climate change, that they think if, you know, the upfront cost to the government will produce savings in the long term. So they provided these aren't technical exemptions. Like, the way they did it is they said the budget chair on coronavirus related legislation and on climate related legislation can declare there is no cost. So it's not an actual exemption to PAYGO in that it doesn't trigger PAYGO because the budget chair can go to the floor and say there's no cost to this legislation, but it does allow them to get around PAYGO on those two issues. And the climate one was a big one for,
another change I've read about talks about disseminating manipulated media. What's in that?
So that one is interesting because the package as it was released on Friday had a provision to basically make it a House ethics violation for members to knowingly disseminate distorted video, audio, et cetera, you know, things that are called deepfakes. People are manipulating this footage, intending to mislead the public. And that drew some controversy, and people thought that was just a bit too far, that there weren't any real parameters around it. So the Democrats actually did on their own last night post an updated change to the rules package that took out that provision and replaced it with one asking the House Ethics Committee to study the issue and then to report back by the end of the year on what, if any, ethics violations they would recommend for members who are distributing deepfakes. Republicans continue to complain about it. I don't think they realize that change was made.
We're talking with Lindsay McPherson, reporter with Roll Call. So it's a new Congress. What is on the agenda this week?
There's not much legislation on the agenda. The House on Tuesday is going to take up a handful of suspension bills. These are usually non-controversial measures that have broad bipartisan support. The committees haven't yet been set up and organized to start reporting bills out of committee, so they're not ready for legislative action. The big thing is on Wednesday, per the Constitution, the Congress meets in a joint session to count the electoral votes in the presidential election. This is usually non-controversial, just kind of formality, but this year, as President Donald Trump has been contesting the election results and other Republicans have joined him in those calls, they are turning the objection or the electoral vote counting process into a forum in which they can object to the results. And several House and Senate Republicans have said they plan to object. It only takes one House member and one Senate member to file a written objection to a particular state's electoral votes being counted. And they are looking at least six swing states like Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. Sure, I missed one there, but that they're going to file written objections to. And what happens then is the House and Senate will have to leave the joint session to go deliberate separately, and then they will vote on whether to sustain or override the objection. Because Democrats control the House, and they don't find any claims to these allegations Republicans have raised about election fraud, they're going to vote it down. The Senate is also likely to vote it down. It's not widely supported over there. So we kind of know at the end of the day, the results are going to stay what they are. but it's going to make for a longer than usual process, and it will provide Republicans an ability to show whether they stand with Donald Trump or not on this issue.
Lindsay McPherson, senior House reporter with Roll Call. Read more at rollcall.com. Thank you very much.
Thanks, as always, for having me.
And the House of Representatives passed that rules package we talked about today on a party line vote, 217 to 206. Democrats, yes. Republicans, no. You heard Lindsay McPherson talking about Wednesday's counting of the Electoral College votes in a joint session of Congress, a March for Trump protest set for that day in front of the White House. The president has promoting that and other protests this week on Twitter, calling them very big and wild, as he does not concede he lost the presidential race to Joe Biden. Today, Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser spoke about the protests. It came in this context. It was a question to her and the new police chief, Robert Conte, about a new Republican member of Congress who promises she's going to carry her gun to work despite D.C. laws.
The congresswoman from Colorado, are you familiar with her tweets about she has, if you believe her video that she has posted, she has brought a Glock 9 into the district onto Capitol Hill. I know she's allowed to have it on the Capitol campus, but she videotaped herself walking the streets of Washington, D.C., apparently with this gun concealed. And I'm just wondering what your message to her is. Is she breaking the law? Do you plan to investigate this? What can you tell us about this?
Yeah, I only recently heard about that within the last 30 minutes or so. What I will say to that is there are no exceptions in the District of Columbia. As you mentioned, well, with the exception of being able to carry in U.S. On U.S. Capitol Police property. For the District of Columbia, we plan to reach out to the Congresswoman's office to make sure that she is aware of what the laws of the District of Columbia are, what the restrictions are, and that Congresswoman, whoever it is, I guess it was from Colorado, you know, will be subjected to the same penalties or anyone else that's caught on the District of Columbia street carrying a firearm. Unlawfully, I might add.
Mayor Bowser, have you seen her video where she characterizes the district as one of the most dangerous cities in the country?
I haven't.
Do you have any message for her?
I'll just add to what the chief says. This is serious business. We should all take very seriously an American's ability to exercise his or her First Amendment rights, and we do. But we also have to know that we have a serious threat to our democracy right now, that the will of American people through a fair and just election is being questioned and violence is being incited. And that leaves the men and women who have sworn an oath to protect public safety in a very difficult position. The men and women of the Metropolitan Police Department, United States Park Police, United States Capitol Police, the Secret Service are all going to be out to protect the First Amendment, but also to protect people and property. Okay, so that's it. It angers me, actually, that any elected official would incite violence, put our city at risk, to put these men and women in law enforcement at risk, our residents at risk, and our beautiful city at risk. And I call on them to stand down on that activity, regardless of their political views. Our Constitution will endure. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris will be the president and the vice president of the United States on January the 20th.
Washington, D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser and Washington, D.C. Police Chief Robert Conte at a news conference today. That member of Congress from Colorado they were referring to is Lauren Boebert. Members of the group Proud Boys, the all-male far-right extremists with ties to white nationalism, say that they plan to come to Washington this week to roam the streets looking for counter-protesters. An Associated Press writes, according to U.S. defense official Muriel Bowser, put in a request on New Year's Eve to have National Guard members on the streets from January 5th through 7th to help with the protests. Officials said the D.C. National Guard members will be used for traffic control and other assistance, but they will not be armed or wearing body armor. Turning to the coronavirus pandemic, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson outlining some tougher restrictions to slow the spread as that new, more contagious strain of virus is circulating in that country. Britain seeing over 50,000 new COVID-19 infections per day for the past week.
With most of the country already under extreme measures, it's clear that we need to do more together to bring this new variant under control while our vaccines are rolled out. In England, we must therefore go into a national lockdown which is tough enough to contain this variant. That means the government is once again instructing you to stay at home. You may only leave home for limited reasons permitted in law, such as to shop for essentials, to work if you absolutely cannot work from home, to exercise, to seek medical assistance, such as getting a COVID test, or to escape domestic abuse. The full details of what you can and can't do will be available at gov.uk/coronavirus. If you are clinically extremely vulnerable, we're advising you to begin shielding again, and you will shortly receive a letter about what this means for you. And because we now have to do everything we possibly can to stop the spread of the disease, primary schools, secondary schools, and colleges across England must move to remote provision from tomorrow, except for vulnerable children and the children of key workers. Everyone will still be able to access early years settings such as nurseries. We recognise that this will mean it's not possible or fair for all exams to go ahead this summer as normal. The Education Secretary will work with Ofqual to put in place alternative arrangements. We will provide extra support to ensure that pupils entitled to free school meals will continue to receive them while schools are closed, and we will distribute more devices to support remote education. I completely understand the inconvenience and distress this late change will cause millions of parents and pupils up and down the country. Parents whose children were in school today may reasonably ask why we did not take this decision sooner. And the answer is simply that we have been doing everything in our power to keep schools open, because we know how important each day in education is to children's life chances. And I want to stress that the problem is not that schools are unsafe for children. Children are still very unlikely to be severely affected by even the new variant of COVID. The problem is that schools may nonetheless act as vectors for transmission, causing the virus to spread between households. Today, the United Kingdom's chief medical officers have advised that the country should move to alert level 5, meaning that if action is not taken, NHS capacity may be overwhelmed within 21 days.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson in London. Total coronavirus deaths in the United Kingdom are now over 75,000. In the United States, deaths now over 360,000. And a new University of Washington forecast says that will go to over 500,000 in 1 month, even as the vaccines are being rolled out. But today, a New York nurse who was the first in the U.S. to receive a dose of Pfizer vaccine last month received her second shot, becoming one of the first in the country to be fully inoculated. On Wall Street, the Dow was down 382, NASDAQ down 189, S&P down 55. And the Transportation Security Administration saying over 3 million people passed through U.S. airport security checkpoints over the holiday weekend despite public health warnings against traveling. That includes 1.3 million on Sunday, the highest daily number since the pandemic began. Thanks for being with us on Washington Today. Get the free C-SPAN radio app to listen anywhere and get our podcasts, including of this program, wherever you get your podcasts. I hope you have a good evening.